Student Center, Portland State University, ground floor, April 27th, Tuesday, Glenn Owen, Cascadia Public Radio.
It's all right. I heard it.
Thank you for all coming. This is our first lecture series on sociology of Islam and Muslim societies. You can check our website from here, pdx.edu/sociologyofislam or sociologyofislam.org. And this is our first lecture series. And second one on 27, as you can see from our website, basically, Islam and the United States. Sheikh Halit Yasin will talk about on Islam in the United States, Thursday, May 27th. Sheikh Halit Yasin, who has a PhD from the Columbia University on Ibn Haldun, basically, is gonna come here. And another speaker, probably we will have May 21st, Necmettin El Yusufi, and he's gonna talk about his PhD dissertation on early Islamic political thought. If you can check our homepage, you will have the information. Today we have a Ari Baron from Israel, Tel Aviv University, and he's going to talk about Islamic political identity in Europe. Ari is currently a PhD student in political science in France and Tel Aviv. His dissertation focuses on the formation of an Islamic political identity in contemporary Europe. So he's going to present his PhD dissertation.
Hi, welcome. I'll try to make sure I speak loud enough so you can hear in the back, and if I don't hesitate to holler out if I start speaking too quickly or my voice goes down a little bit. Thank you for coming. I am going to talk about my... Hold on one second. I'm going to talk about my PhD dissertation. I'm still in the middle of it. I finished my research. I've started writing. For the presentation today, I'll probably go a little bit back and forth between the academic style, research methodology, kind of conceptual thinking, and a little bit more of a presentation. So there's going to be a little mix of both. Also, I won't bring up as many citations of sources, just so I don't bore you too much. But a lot of the things, or a lot of the facts I'm bringing up do have citations, so also don't hesitate to ask me towards the end if there's questions. I'm talking about Islamic political identity in Europe. But really, the longer title, which I didn't feel like it was appropriate to put on here, is the Islamic discourse in Europe on the Islamic political identity in Europe. As was read out, I am doing a PhD. One of my advisors is in France, so I do have some European connection. But I was actually born in Portland, Oregon, so it's nice to come back. But I'm American, I'm Israeli, I'm Jewish. I don't really have the qualities of being Muslim or Europe, so there's not much that I can convey from my personal experience, but Bernard Lewis once said that you don't have to be a fish to study marine biology. So there are other things you can study, even if you're not, but if not part of that specific group. So one of the reasons, or one of the ways, I found I could then attach myself to a topic that's very interesting to me, is by studying the Islamic discourse within Europe, and it's very dynamic, and that's what we're going to be going over today. Afterwards, through my brief presentation, I don't know, I'll probably speak for 20 to 30 minutes, hopefully, something like that. Then afterwards, there will be rooms for questions at the end. As you can see, I'm going to talk a little bit at the beginning about the research part of it. That's the bulk of my research. But beforehand, because I'm not sure what people do know or don't know about Islam in Europe or sort of political identity in Europe whatsoever, there'll be a little bit of a brief review. And at the end, I'm going to bring up case studies. So how do we go from the background to the actual bulk of the research to then how is that actually working out on the ground. Because a lot of time in academic studies, and as you'll see, you have to frame things up and put them in little diagrams, and you have to make sure that it's a little dry, because that's the way, I don't know if how many people are trying to do their PhDs or thinking about it. It's actually, there's a real reason for it, but then afterwards, seeing how the case studies sort of work out, that should hopefully be what's a little more interesting. So I'm going to start with talking about political identity in general in Europe. And we'll put the Islamic part aside for a little bit. Throughout the history of Europe, and this is a brief overview, political identity has developed over several centuries, but then has gradually turned to be a secular identity. If you go back to political theory, you go back to John Locke or Jean-Jacques Rousseau or many others, the concept of what is the state and what is political identity has developed into something that is secular, the concept of secularism. It's not that religion or religious identity wasn't an integral part of a person's lives, but all of a sudden, you had a political theory that separated the public life where you would be secular and the private life where you could be religious. This is something that happened gradually over time, but then political theory institutionalized that, created the functions of what would be a secular government. And in the European Union today, you have 27 different governments, different countries, different interpretations of what is secularism. There's a difference between France and the UK. In America and the West, there's also a different concept of it, of what is secular, what is the separation between church and state. However, that was sort of brought in and institutionalized into what is called either a social contract or a secular government. That said, specifically since around the 1980s, but I think gradually, I mean, has always been a part of political theory, but specifically since the mid-80s, gradually into the 1990s, religion or religious belief or religious institutions have also been gradually increasing their influence within the political sphere. I'm talking per se, we'll talk about the Islamic side in a little bit, but even just status quo, if you look in Europe, the different branches of Christianity, how they're trying to then influence, lobby, organize, or get their ideas involved into the political and the public sphere. And that's something that, as you watch, religion and religious ideas and the value system that people had from beforehand are starting to also play a role in how they believe, and that's always been the case, even when you go back to political theory. But now there's starting to be a more willingness to talk about it out in the open and have that be something that you're connected to. I think that's more so in Europe than in America. But really, there's still that balance of how do you then integrate religious practice, religious thought in the public sphere and in the private sphere. It's a very brief history, but here all of a sudden you come into then how you incorporate Islam in Europe, Muslims in Europe, how Muslims who want to practice religion, and we'll go into that into more detail, how they can then incorporate themselves into what is considered generally a secularist political identity, and what happens if you want to increase their religious practices within that, and how do you then balance the two. But a brief review before we get into more depth about what I just said. I don't know how many people are familiar with the history between Europe and Islam in general. It started pretty much at the foundations of Islam in the 7th century. Maybe several decades afterwards, when Islam started expanding, there was, now the brief overview just goes by conquest. Muslims sort of expanding. They made it into areas in southern Spain and other areas as well. And then there were the Crusades, so the Christians struck back, and it went back and forth right around the 15th century as well. Then Muslims also had another breadth of expansion before institutionalizing what would be called the Ottoman Empire. There was also another branching of Islam in Europe. And if you go over the history of it, a lot of it is violent, but there is some cultural exchange back in the medieval times between Islam and Christianity, between Islam and Europe, or what would become Europe. And so there's a lot of exchanges, and it depends on how you want to focus on it. But what I'm going to be focusing on is more of a contemporary history. We'll call it post-World War II. There's a lot of connection to colonialism or colonialist countries. So there is some layover effect from what happened in the earlier part of the 20th century and even in the 19th century. And the fact of the colonialism played a role because as Europe got out of World War II and realized the devastation and needed workers or needed more population and needed people to come in and help rebuild the country both socially and but also infrastructure-wise, a lot of workers were needed and brought in not only but also from Muslim countries. In that sense, there was a lot of workers who were brought in if you were from France, and the colonial history went back to Morocco, for example, Algeria, then a lot of workers came from there because there was a history, there was a language. Pakistan and India to Britain, also in Germany a little bit, and I'll get into a little more of the differences, but there was some history, and Right around after World War II, Europe brings in a large amount of workers, gradually thinking, if you come in, work a little bit, send some money back, and then afterwards you'll go back home. That was the general plan. Thing is, most people stayed. I mean, for, I think, obvious reasons. If you can make more money and send money home and have a better lifestyle, then why would you want to leave voluntarily? And at that stage, Europe still needed more people, so why would they leave and other people replace them? So now what you have is first to fifth generation people living in Europe. I mean, there are people who have been born and have grandchildren and great-grandchildren who are fully European, and that's what we're going to start talking about, the balance. But then you have a gradual number of increased immigration, which is something that's continued till today, and if you look at the policy plans of the European Union, increased immigration also from Muslim countries or from countries with Muslim backgrounds, there's still a desire to increase immigration. So that's something that we're also going to touch on a little bit. Today, it's very hard to pinpoint a specific number of how many Muslims live in Europe. The general understood number is about 20 million. It's hard because on a census, you can't ask somebody what their religion is. So you have to go by sort of what their name is or sort of affiliations. But that's around the generally understood number. I wrote from over 30 countries, but it's pretty much from every country that has a Muslim population in it. There are Muslims living in Europe. So we have a very diverse community, and that actually creates a problem. And that's something that we're also going to talk about, the political mobilization. If somebody says, what is Islamic political identity? The first question you should ask is, well, one is political identity, but the second is there an Islamic political identity, let alone in Europe? And if you have about 30 countries with people coming forward, 20 million people, I think it'd be very hard to determine an Islamic political identity. At least that's when I looked at the board and I started understanding this. I tried to figure out, first of all, I was actually going to study these three countries, France, Britain, and Germany, and then compare between them. What I think I discovered, but people had discovered much before me, is that the Muslim community in France is significantly different than the Muslim community in Britain, which is significantly different than the Muslim community in Germany. In France, like I said, you have mostly, predominantly Muslim immigrants coming from Algeria and Morocco. In Britain, mainly, at least from the majority are from Pakistan or India, although there is a lot of other immigrants from other Muslim countries, other countries in the Middle East. In Germany, it's mainly a Turkish population, although there are some differences as well. And each one of those, just you focusing on those three countries, each one of those populations brings in a separate local tradition. Turkish Muslim is different than an Algerian Muslim, which is different than a Pakistani Muslim. You also have several differences between how they practice, what language they speak, what their desires are. Also, then add on to that, that France, Germany, and Britain, the major countries in America, sorry, in Europe, have a different type of government, a different opinion to what we were talking about before between political identity. The relationship between secular identity, secularism, between religion and secular affairs within the state. And that's where you start seeing a vast diversity of different type of Islamic political identities within Europe, which has really been very fragmenting or caused a great amount of fragmentation within the Muslim population within Europe. So all of a sudden, what you find, though, is as you have more and more people, specifically with Muslim immigrant backgrounds, living in Europe for a longer period of time and feeling more European and trying to incorporate their Islamic background as well, their Muslim background, what you have is, this is what I find most important. The Muslim communities or Muslims are finding that they have two things in common with and out throughout all of Europe. One, that they're Muslim, although they're different from different backgrounds like we just discussed. But they're also European. That's also different. A German is not a French, is not a British person, but they're also in some sort of quasi, what is now the European Union, but a general political consensus. And so now what Muslims are realizing is that they're both, and maybe they have some things that are more in common than our differences. And more than that, and as we'll talk about in the case studies, maybe if you can overcome some cultural and ethnic differences or divisions, you can actually find ways to challenge the state or receive more diplomatic or democratic rights. Basically increase the funding you would get from government sources. That's a general overview. And as we start to go into more discussion, at the end when we get to questions, if there are more questions about the general, I'm happy to talk about it. But now where I'm gonna start to get into a little bit of like the academic side, my research questions, I've sort of, I put them up clear, I tried to define two strict questions and they're based off of each other. The first line that you'll see up there is sort of a little bit of a background, but the first question that I come up with is, what is Islamic political identity? And it's sort of a problematic question because, as I just said, there's not an Islamic political identity. But by asking this question, I actually, and throughout my answers, as you'll see in a little bit, that there are multiple different types of Muslim or Islamic political identities within Europe. And so that's my first question. How does the internal European Islamic discourse define itself? Because I think, looking from it, from outside of Europe, that's different than seeing what do Muslims within Europe think about the discourse that they have within it, within Europe. And that's the first question. The second is, then, if you have an Islamic political identity within Europe, or several of them, as I argue, you're also going to have to see, then, how do the different people integrate different concepts of religion into their secular or European sort of identity? Because I don't know how many of you are religious at all, or have religious friends, or have more than one religious friend, whether it be Christianity, Judaism, or Islam for sure. There's not one concept of Islam. There's not one concept of any type of religion. There's different ways of practicing, of believing, and most of the time, the internal debate and religious practice is what's very interesting. So then as different people, different scholars, different people come in and try to define the integration of Islamic principles and political principles into their identity, that's where you get a big bit of diversity. So this is my research questions. That's what I came to start with. Don't worry, the slides get a little brighter. I did this intentionally because we're going to start to go over. So what did I... over each one of these four different scholars. One of the things I recognized as I was starting to do my research was that, one, there are multiple different perspectives on Islamic political identity. That's what I've just been talking about. But then the question is, well, are you talking about in France? Are you talking about in a different country in Europe? So one of the things that I found interesting was that, yes, there are people in France who are trying to unify the Muslim population of France. But what I also found is there are a significant number of Muslim scholars who are based in Europe or are European themselves, who are trying to create an overall concept of political identity throughout all Muslims within Europe. Not that all Muslims think the same, but that there's a way to unify them. But what I also found is that there's a diverse spectrum of analysis. I'm going to go over four different scholars, talk about the four different people, and you'll see, and I'm emphasizing, I chose these four because together they don't agree on very much. They're all Muslim. They all talk about Islamic political identity within Europe in various forms. And there's a significant difference in almost every different viewpoint that they have, which is actually fantastic. Meaning, and one of the things I'll argue and I'll say at the end, is that almost everybody, every Muslim in Europe, has to chew in their own combination of the integration of Islamic principles and secular principles, or we'll call it European principles, into their own lifestyle. And these four, I claim, make a full spectrum that then allow everybody to then not say, I'm going to follow each one of them, some of them do, some of them don't, but at least de facto is a way of academically going through the process of analyzing what I still call Islamic political identity in Europe. The first person I'm going to analyze is Bassam Tibi. Before I go into him a little bit, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go over these four. I'll keep it rather short. I'm happy to then expand upon it later. But my point is that when I do my research, I go over their personal history, their personal background. And then I start comparing them on different categories, which I'm going to get into when I'm finished with giving the general background. But Bassam Tibi, originally born in Syria, moved to Germany when he was very young, when he was 18 years old. He's now retired from being an academic professor. He's toured the world, both from the West Coast to Harvard on the East Coast to Indonesia, pretty much in every single country and every single continent in the world. But his concept, he's a self-proclaimed reform Muslim. At least he studied philosophy, political philosophy. So he believes in the separation between religion as a concept of a belief and religion as a social construct, as a practice. I don't know if anybody's familiar with Habermas, the German philosopher, but he was a student of Habermas. He follows through Habermas very well, and he's taken that one step further. I think he is a reform Muslim in practice, but when he writes, he's also talking about more of the secular version of Islam. He's showing that there is a way that Islam can be a secularist culture, that you can have secularism within Islam, which when we get to the end, we'll see that not everybody agrees with him. He also tries to deconstruct political Islam. He wants to take away the political activism from Islam and create people to be both Muslim and European with no interaction between the two, with no conflict between the two. He really wants people to be able to be European first and afterwards have in their own private life a religious identity as they like. So that's actually following through on the more standard, typical, what I would call the status quo European identity of maintaining secularism. So he would be at the one side of the spectrum. Next I have the scholar that I'm studying is Tariq Ramadan. Has anybody heard of Tariq Ramadan? All right. He I'll go over him quickly, but he was born in Geneva, fully European, as much as anybody can be. His grandfather was the person who founded the Muslim Brotherhood. But what is interesting is that Tariq Ramadan is starting to then incorporate these sort of principles of both from his father, Islamic awakening, this Islamic coming together, the revival of Islam, but also doing it from Europe as a European. And so what his main thrust is that Muslims in Europe have a dual identity, or multiple identities. He goes up to saying he has six identities. But for our argument, he has a dual identity of both being Muslim and European, and how do you then integrate the two? So for Bassam Tibi, it's more of a cross of how do you then assimilate or very much become European. For Tariq Ramadan, he talks about contributing. Muslims in Europe need to contribute to society. Muslims in Europe can maintain their own independence as Muslims in Europe and never lose their cultural background, but then also contribute to the rest of Europe. He states that Islam is a very European religion, and if it wasn't in the past, it is today. And with 20 million Muslims living in Europe, it's very hard to say that maybe he's wrong, although there's some other different conflicts of interest between him and other scholars, but that's what makes him very interesting in this spectrum of the four scholars that I'm talking about. Amr Khaled he's in the UK right now. He's born and raised, lived his life in Egypt. Actually, he was trained as an accountant and worked as an accountant for a long period of time. If anybody wants to go into accounting, I praise you. I might hire you in the future. But I don't know how to do accounting, but he was an accountant who was very charismatic. Because one day he was asked to give a lecture in a mosque, and since then he's gotten up to be one of the most influential Muslims or Muslim scholars in the world. I think he had a period of time where he was leading prayer for over 40,000 people during Ramadan in Egypt, but he was also so popular or becoming so controversial within Europe that Egypt banned him, sent him, and he moved to the UK. His concept is, and I sort of shut it up here, Islam is a middle nation. His term is Islam as paving a golden road. But middle nation meaning that Islam or Muslims in Europe can actually sort of bridge a gap in some case. But what he would like to do is, his version is to integrate in a positive way without dissolving. What he wants people to do is to be proud of being Muslim, to be European as well, to share the two cultures, different than what Tariq Ramadan says, but to never lose the fact that you're part of a Muslim population, a part of the Muslim nation. He still says that you should integrate a little bit and find out the balance. The last or the fourth scholar that I'm talking about is Yusuf Qaradawi. Has anybody heard of him? Does anybody know? Okay, so maybe just a couple. Yusuf Qaradawi is, he's 84 now, I believe. If you want to talk about influential scholars, he's incredibly, not only influential, I mean, he's written over 60 books, he's published thousands of fatwas, he's actually of the four that I'm studying, the only true religious or qualified person. He can actually issue a fatwa and people actually follow it for the most part. He also, although he's 84, he is very in touch with technology. He has a weekly show on Al Jazeera. He uses the internet and technology very well. He is actually the only person who does not live in Europe. He had a brief stint of period who was in Europe. The reason why I use him as part of the Islamic political identity, or I can still say the internal discourse, is because he founded two different think tanks that are founded and based in Europe that are actually based in promoting what's called Fiqh al-Kalayat, although I probably pronounce it a little, I still have the pronunciation a little off. It's finding a way for having Muslims who are living in non-Muslim countries be able to live a Muslim lifestyle. His perspective, or his main thrust, is that you should always be Muslim, Islam first, and that you should only do in your daily life what is good for Islam, and you can only practice democratic means within Europe so long as it's in Islam's best interest, or what you view as the best interest of Islam. These four together, as I go through these four together and as I study them all together, they're all, like I said, they're different. They have different concepts. They actually have a discourse in between them as well. Not everybody refers to everybody by name, but people then talk about the different topics, the different concepts that they're mentioning. And so what I think is, by having the four of them together, it creates what I define as a spectrum of identity. This is a very, and again, a simplified version of it. But really what it is, if you take secular identity on the right and religious identity on the left, for example, and per se, you'd have somebody choosing somebody along the whole identity. Everybody fits in some sort of integration of either secular or religious identity. No religious identity, you're fully on the right. Bassam Tibi is not necessarily fully on the right, and Qaradawi is not fully on the left. But I think the four pretty much complete the whole spectrum. In essence, I think there are two different people or two different categories. It'd be one more on the left, people who are fully secular and don't talk about Islam whatsoever in their identity. The people who would be fully on the right, maybe even a little bit completely secular. But that's not as interesting because they're part of the Islamic discourse, but they don't talk about it. So it's hard to compare them. A sixth person or an additional one would be somebody who's more on the left, somebody who actually promotes violence, somebody who's very aggressive, somebody who has no recognition whatsoever of the West at all. And that would be somebody who would be on the other side of the spectrum. I also find because they're not part of a discourse, it's less relevant for what I'm talking about as my dissertation. And so I've left them out, so I talk about these four who I think fit fully into this spectrum. Does that make sense up until now? We're okay? All right, because now is when I've talked about four other things. I'm going to start talking about the other part. This is where I talk about my research methodology. If it gets a little too, I'll try to keep it from getting too contained. I find four concentric circles, meaning the spectrum that we just looked at is very interesting to see, or I find very interesting to see, but then how do you then compare these four people? If I want to talk about comparing them, I can just read a lot of their works and say, you know, this one said A, B, and C, but then all of a sudden, in order to maintain an academic dissertation, in order to prove that something's valid or not, even though we're talking about the social sciences, you have to come up with a construct, with a series of categories in order to maintain validity. So the construct that I came up with is actually maintaining something, these four levels of analysis. I'm going to start with civilizational, transnational, national, and local. But local is at the heart of it, and we'll get into it in a little bit. What I mean is, this is a more European way of describing or dissecting identity. So what you have is a way of focusing on these four scholars, but then comparing them in a way that actually allows for a bit of analysis on all levels, from the most local to the most broad way of political thinking. So that's why I find a way of combining Muslims who are talking about an identity in Europe and a way of constructing a political identity, so a way of thinking about it. When I talk about civilizational, I mean the most broadest form of identity. The broadest concept is, are you religious from your starting point or secular from your starting point? I think that is where it all turns on. You can be a little bit religious, as we saw, there's a spectrum, but the question is, where do you place yourself? And what I mean by civilizational is, what are you a part of? If we're part of the West, or if European culture is part of a Western society that's developed a Western culture, that's part of a Westernized concept of identity, that's different than a Chinese identity, a Russian identity, a Middle Eastern identity. And so there's a different way of thinking about it. And so I think us in the West, specifically in Europe, view themselves as it's Western-centric. And I don't know how many people who study international relations start realizing how a Western-centric attitude is wonderful as long as you don't isolate yourself from other types of identities or other type of centric attitudes as well, and then realize maybe we're better or not better, but taking away the normative part of it, and then comparing the two. A lot of times in Western concept of identity is such that you think you're the best, or at least in international relations, that's so it's taught specifically in the West, and then you have a hard time looking at other different cultural identities. And what I find, each of the four scholars, even Bassam Tibi, who's the most, we'll call it, Europeanized, they all say there's a crisis of identity within Europe. Specifically in Europe, but also in the West. And so there's this comparison of, where do you work in? How do you then compare the different types of identities? Are you more Islamic focused, or are you more secular focused? Do you focus on divine law, which is actual natural law? Do you focus on man-made law, positive law? And there's a conflict. Which do you follow? And we'll see that how that comes up in France with burqas or the head coverings and other parts of identity as well. The next level, if you take away just a general concept which is not tangible, goes into transnational. The European Union is a transnational identity, entity. It's a construct. It's built up of several different nations. In essence, it's a way of, when somebody says, I'm European, they're saying, I am part of this transnational identity. Most of the time, some people say, first I'm French or British, and then I'm also European. Depends on where you are. But this transnational construct is a way of thinking about the system. The Western concept of system is based on nation states. As it's based on nation states, it's all focused around a nation, and so you have a transnational entity. But in Islam, traditionally, up until the last several decades, or since post-World War II beforehand, there wasn't the nation as was defined by the Western concept of nation. Actually, in Western concept of nation is also relatively new. So what you have is a different type of nation, an Islamic nation. It's based on a religious entity, the Ummah. The Islamic Ummah, or Ummah, the Islamic nation, is based around religion. All Muslims are part of this nation. It's based on religion. So as you combine the two, there's a different way of thinking about a transnational identity. So somebody in Europe, a Muslim in Europe, who's now trying to be both part of the Islamic Ummah, or the Muslim nation, and a transnational identity, has to balance between these two, and it's definitely possible. The question is in which level, which proportion you can compare between them. There's another way of looking at transnational, which allows you to then focus on different countries, relations of different countries. Like I said, the European Union is a transnational entity, but also, so that means that's also a transnational network. But another way of looking at it is a Muslim from Morocco who lives in France, or has lived in France, or his family has lived in France for several generations, but maintains a connection with Morocco, is maintaining a transnational identity with somebody outside. Somebody from Germany, a Muslim Turk from Germany who maintains relations with Turkey, is actually maintaining another transnational entity, and we'll get to that a little bit as well. The third level, another level, is nationalism. Basically, this revolves around what you think the state is there for. I haven't really talked about topics, but you have Gellner citations, like the one concept of a nation is that a nation is there to create a political identity that then unifies diverse ethnic cultures. That's what happened in France, actually. Another concept is that civil society comes together and they themselves determine what should be the construct of the state. And it's the continuous conflict between these two perspectives that happens in Europe and America and any country. Really, does the state get to determine or do you get to determine? And that really is what plays a role in determining the individual identity. It's what part of the nation then do you feel that you're a part of? The last bit here, I don't know if everybody can see it, but I wrote a question, does a passport define citizenship? The question is more than just symbolic, because a lot of Muslims in Europe have a passport. The question is, do they feel that they're part of the country? Are they really citizenship? Actually, that's a quote from Bassam Tibi he mentioned. He says, to be part of a country is more than just having the passport. And a lot of times, actually, if you want to become an American citizen, you have to pass a test, an American culture test. Actually, a lot of similar concepts are being passed in Europe as well. How do you then be integrated a little bit more into society so you know a little bit about the history and not just be somebody who has a passport? And that's something that plays in this role. And like I said a little bit at the beginning, the most important element, at least I find, is the local, the communal element. Everything revolves around localities. It's how you view themselves, how you view what you're talking about on a local level. Are you religious? Are you not religious? What do you do in your private life? And then after your private life, how do you want to then go out and portray it in the public sphere, which is where the major differences come from? Really, what it does is it creates two levels of a social sphere, of social actions, people who are religious and not religious. And that's where in Europe the real discussion is coming. Can you then have different types of social norms or social actions, or how can you then incorporate everybody a unified way of practicing your life, your lifestyle, your private life, but then also incorporate it with different people who have different elements of their religious belief? And the last point I have over here, I had mentioned it briefly beforehand, but what's really important to talk about is then what does it mean to practice religion also in your private life, let alone in your public life? Do you practice religion because of cultural reasons, community reasons, because you're very very pious, very believing? I think there's a vast reasons why people practice religion, what it does for them both spiritually but also as a social movement. And so that's where you have the differences coming up within these four areas, or on your local level as well. So what I find interesting, and I'm almost done, I promise, with the methodological, the little more dry, cut and dry academic part of it, is that these four levels are interdynamic. And really what's interesting is that they're inseparable from each other. People have a different value system placed on each level. And actually, when you talk about forming an Islamic political identity, it's how people then view these different levels, the local, the national, transnational, civilizational, I'm going to have a drink of water, sorry. The civilizational, in order for them to be able to come together. So it's a combination of these four levels that makes the foundation of Islamic political identity very interesting. Okay, like I said, I'm done. A little bit of a matrix and then we move on. And what I just talked about is four different scholars over here and the four different levels over here. If you just look at what Yosef Karadawi said, you have a great summary on Yosef Karadawi. You can write a book about him as well, even a PhD dissertation. Several have been written about him specifically. If you just look over here, we'll go along the concept of civilizational identity, you have a very good element of what different Muslims in Europe think about civilizational identity. But if what I'm saying is true, which is these four make a complete spectrum of Muslim of the Muslim discourse within Europe, and these four have a complete construct of what it is to have political identity, and the combination of all of these two areas come up with what is Islamic political identity in Europe. So for all those who didn't expect to have such a cut and dry part of what we're talking about, here's where we get into a little bit of interesting part. Because when you talk about anything academic, you have to draw sections, like we saw different squares, and there's borderline. But really, I think we all know is that the real life is a little more dynamic than that. It's a little more interesting. What really happens on the ground? So really, what I think is what I've talked about up until now really happens on the ground, explains what we're gonna talk about, but what we see as far as what Muslims are doing on the ground in Europe. But I think what you have here, what's more important is by looking about what's really happening, you can actually see the diversity, the desire to overcome different ethnic and cultural backgrounds and differences in order to be able to garner more political rights, it's a political mobilization. So I also divide this into three categories, but it's less important. But really the first category is internally within a country. This is the one of the predominant Muslim groups within France. This is one of the major groups within Britain. They're umbrella groups, meaning in Britain, I think there was 250, maybe now closer to 300 major Muslim groups in different countries, in different localities, and each one was doing sort of their own thing. But when the British government came up and said, we want to talk to your leader, it was very hard for the British government to then be able to organize and discuss things with 250 different groups. So what was formed naturally in Britain without the help of the government was the Muslim Council of Britain. And so now there's point of contact is the proper term. In Europe, in France it was a little different. In France, actually, the French government under now President Sarkozy, but beforehand he was Minister of Interior, created a Muslim group to come up and say, listen, in France we need somebody to talk to. Government relations with a non-government entity, let's figure out how we can talk to. And then the government actually helped unify the Muslims, the various Muslims community, into what they were, what they are now today, which is since 2003, unified group, we can call it a lobbying group on the one hand, but a cultural group, so that there's somebody to talk to. Somebody then organize with. When Muslims in France want to then try to receive more funding for building up educational centers or anything else, they can go through this in order to talk to the government, which is proven to be very helpful. The problem is, with internally, you still have these differences. Transnational, when I talk about this, is that when I talk about Tariq Ramadan, he's from Geneva. He's based in Geneva, but he's also writing about Islam in general. But when after the bombings that happened in London, one of the things the government of Britain did was put together a report, preventing extremism together. One of the things they did was they invited Tariq Ramadan. He was very influential, had very what the government at the time thought was very good ideas about how to unify Islam in Europe. And so what they did is they brought somebody who was not British whatsoever into this internal policy group of how to then influence Muslim policy or policy of the government towards Muslims within Britain. So now all of a sudden you have this little bit of transnational element coming in, realizing that Muslims in Europe they have a lot of things in similar as well. Another thing is President Ida. Has anybody heard of what happened in Switzerland, the referendum? Okay, so what happened in November 29th of last year, there was a referendum. It's just the way the political system in Switzerland works. The referendum was brought up by the right wing, the very traditionalist groups in Switzerland, in order to ban the building of minarets on mosques, meaning they didn't have a problem with building of mosques, of prayer rooms, just without a minaret, because the minarets were defacing or changing the face of Switzerland. It was causing uproar, loud calls to prayer, and everything was a problem. So the whole country on the 29th of November went to the polls. Now, if you go back and look at it, we look at the statistics, there are over 200 prayer rooms in Switzerland. Four of them have minarets in the whole country. So why they're talking about this issue is interesting. And at the time, there were no plans of building another mosque with another minaret. But now it was agreed upon that the referendum passed in order to prevent the building of mosques with minarets. Now, what I found very interesting, and I've talked about this in other lectures that I've given, is that what the Muslim community did in building up to this referendum wasn't fight them or say it's if you pass this, we're going to write, we'll still build a mosque with a minaret. What they did is they lobbied different groups of the Muslim community within Switzerland, who had never talked to each other, or never agreed with each other on anything, that's not me saying, that's them saying, came together, unified themselves, and said, we're going to lobby the rest of Switzerland to say this isn't right. One of the things they also did is they lobbied the Jewish community in Switzerland, saying, if this is happening with mosques, what's going to happen after with synagogues? And actually, the Jewish community supported the Muslim community in this. So if what we saw in November 29th and since then is that Muslims, because of the uprising of more of the right wing coming up and condemning Islamic or Muslim actions, which we can say if that's right or wrong, or right or wrong perception, what is actually causing is this mobilization of Muslims to come together, to unite, to overcome ethnic differences, and then come out and say, let's work together because there's more to be achieved. One more level of this transnational, is what happened in Switzerland could happen in France, or in Holland, or in the UK. And so what Muslims in those countries are also saying is, let's learn from what's going on in Switzerland, and let's coordinate, let's cooperate. So then you have another level of transnational political mobilization. One of the things that's also I find very interesting is now what predominantly the Muslim population in Switzerland did, but other groups as well, the people who didn't want the referendum to pass, was they appealed. They appealed to the European Court of Justice, which is sort of like the Supreme Court here, in many different types of analogies. But what you have is, instead of Muslims going to the streets and rioting and burning cars, which is actually what happened in France in 2003, a lot of youth came out and led a lot of aggression, what you have is Muslims in Europe are coming and utilizing the democratic means of their country, of their state, of the European Union, in order to express their democratic right. So actually what the right wing is doing is causing the Muslim population to unite a little more, which is causing, why I go back to the previous several slides, the ability to be able to say that there's a unification of political identity in general, because people are starting to overcome their ethnic differences, I think. Another issue, and this is a little more controversial, I find, as a European, regardless of the religious context, is Prime Minister of Turkey Erdogan, when he both in 2008 and also recently, when he came to visit Chancellor Merkel of Germany. There's a large Turkish population, Muslim population, for generations in Germany. And they don't have citizenship, predominantly, the most part, because of the German laws, but they have they're residents. So they can vote in more municipal elections, but not national elections, which is just a German system. But what Erdogan said, what the Prime Minister said, was it's time to come up and have Muslims or Turks in Germany strengthen your relation to Germany and have allegiance to Germany. And this has nothing to do really with the religious aspect, this is purely on a secular basis, but now there's this call of having this connection to something international. Merkel didn't take this very, very kindly. She said, first of all, they're German, which is also very interesting, because now Chancellor Merkel is defending their right to be German. And now you have this international sort of cooperation that starts to affect other levels of international relations, which I think is something that will develop over time. I'm going to summarize and open up the questions, but really my main point, if we're talking about the formation of Islamic political identity, if you notice, I didn't try to define it, I didn't try to tell you what I think it is. The only thing I've really tried to say is that there's a diverse discussion, both within Muslim, the internal Islamic discourse, but also between Muslims and non-Muslims. So if anybody tries to say, listen, Muslims are, well, first of all, let's talk about what Muslims are in the first place as far as their different identities and what they're doing, but I think the only thing you can say is that it's a diverse type of discourse that's going on, and it's changing. Identity structures are different. Going back to what I said at the very beginning, how you then incorporate secular tendencies with religious tendencies is something that's always been something that's been controversial, specifically in France, but always within Europe. And that's part of the changing identity. If you ask somebody in Europe today what's going on and what they think will be 20 years down the road, if you would go back in time 20, 30, or 40 years and ask them 40 years ago what happened 20 years down the road, they would be completely surprised about what's happening. So something's changed over time. These trends are happening. And that's what I think is important to look at, because you have a gradual integration of anybody's culture or principles or concepts within society. There are close to 20 million Muslims living in Europe. Of course they're going to integrate and influence society, but so does everybody within society. Now if you start cooperating yourself, you have more power or more ability to influence. The last thing I sort of talk about a little bit is what I think is important to remember sort of in the back of our minds is that there is a difference between a religious concept and a secular concept of identity. There's Jürgensmeier, also a German philosopher, political philosopher, talks about different hierarchies. So how can you then balance this hierarchy of religion and a secular government, and will that work itself into each other? And I think that's where we have, we're talking about the creation or formation of an Islamic political identity within Europe, this sort of confrontation of these two hierarchies, which is part of the dialogue that's been going on in Europe for close to two millennia. Or let's call it simply, for the last 800 years. And that's what I think what we're starting to see, and we're seeing more of a change. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the formation of Islamic political identity. That's at least my presentation, the cut and dry part of my presentation. I imagine that there's something more to talk about in questions and answers, which I'm happy to take about anything.
Thank you.
Also, please introduce yourself.
Yes. Ari, first of all, thank you for being here. Your bio mentions that you have a concentration in international law.
Yes.
Would you comment on the legality of Israel's colonization of the West Bank, Israel's annexation of East Jerusalem, and Israel's annexation of the Syrian Golan Heights, as well as its occupation of Lebanon and Sheba Park?
Yeah, I think this lecture has nothing to do with Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This is about Islamic political identity in Europe. I am a Muslim myself. Was born as a Muslim, raised as a Muslim, grew up as a Muslim. If you want to look at, you know, illegal occupation, I think you should look at Iraq. Since 2003, almost 1.3 million people were killed in Iraq.
Next question. I'm Birol Yeshida, the political science department. I have a question about your research.
Yeah.
Identity issue. You classify four categories based on four scholars.
Yes.
And you have this nice matrix. Then how do you get about mapping identity? Are you doing survey research? Are you using surveys that are already out there? For myself, I do world value survey, if you're familiar with that. And the equivalent of that in Europe would be the European value survey.
Sure.
Do you get into those things and try to, or do you have your own survey?
So first of all, I agree that that's a fundamental part of what we're talking about. I don't have my own surveys for sure. Mm-hmm. That's a different type of research that I'm looking into. I try to take numbers or statistics or perspectives both from the World Values, also from the Pew Forum, from different sort of people who do their own surveys. The reason why I structured the categories or the groups like this is because really I don't want to talk about what my opinion is or the general context. I'm talking about what the four scholars are talking about. So what I try to do then is by dealing with the four, the material and the research and the writings of those four scholars. Now, what I do is when I integrate, at least in the background, and when I do in the introduction part of it, which is more than just, but goes into more depth, mm-hmm. is bring up statistics and details about the Muslim population, about the values. There's several different statistics about how then do you integrate, or how would a Muslim then define himself? Do they define themselves first as a Muslim, and second as whatever state? And so then I go into those statistics, which I found, and I pull in and integrate, because I think that's very influential. But as I'm based in and trying to focus on the scholars, I find I can just focus on, or I hope to be able to focus on, just their works.
Okay. Can I have a quick follow-up suggestion? All right, 20+ million Muslims in Europe. 4.6 to 5 million are Turks, who tend to follow a different line of scholarship, if you want to talk about school of thought.
Yeah.
And there are several of those, and two extremely powerful in German.
Yes.
And from my research in this area, I don't see them being influenced by the four scholars you have identified. Rather, they are influenced by Nakshibandiya of Turkey, great scholars of that, Tarikat, and most influential one in Europe being Sheikh Nazim, the Gulen movement of more recent times. So these, are, in my opinion, are missing.
Yeah.
If you're going to map and show the identity issue, how Muslims in Europe identify themselves, there is this missing link there, a large part.
I agree with you fully. There's a couple missing links, because just like that, the Moroccan or Tunisian or Algerian perspectives in France have different people, and Karada in the Pakistani and Indian.
Right.
And so actually my first discussion, my first concept was to go and study each of the three countries, those three, Britain, France, and Germany, discuss who's influencing the different populations, and then find a way to link and compare. One, I got a little bit lost in the research, meaning you see that there's no way to then compare between them. You can, but it's very artificial. It's forced to be able to compare. And so what I hope to be able to do by focusing on those four, at the expense of losing some of the people who influence the population, I want to talk about the people who then less influence. I agree with you that most of those four scholars don't influence very many people. I think Qaradawi does, even some in maybe less Turks in Germany, but a little bit. But there's less influence, but there's more of a connection. So they do represent more of an artificial but an umbrella sort of way of connecting identity. And I think if you look at the Turkish population in Germany, they might not even have heard of any of those. Maybe Bassam Tibi they have because he's around and controversial in the other perspective. But I think if you then objectively concentrate on how they define the integration of Islamic and European principles, you'll see they still fit in more or less into the different concept, even if they're not influenced or even would like to then be connected to them.
Not quite. Especially if you take Sheikh Nazim's influence and his teachings, you would see a very distinct classic framing of what it means to be a Muslim in Europe and what he teaches you to follow. What I'm saying is that if you're going to use Germany as a case study in this comparison, there are highly influential scholars way up there in the rankings.
Yeah.
Like Sheikh Nazim. He's one of the top three in the world in the Naqshbandi movement. His teachings ought to be included if you want to explain the behavior of German Turks.
So I'll make sure to...
I think it's a missing link there.
I'll make sure to put more emphasis on it. I will.
I was wondering if, in addition to your classification or breakdown of civilizational, transnational, national, and local, if you can drill deeper, and I was thinking specifically of family or kinship networks, and if that plays a role at all, because those tend to be transnational as well.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's when I talk about the local, that's what I want to talk about, the kinship, the family, the communal, up to the level where you talk about on a national level. So that's where I'm focusing on the local part of it, where people bring in their households. Although, because I want to focus on the different level of scholarship, I'm not going to go into each individual household, but I will go into what the four scholars, or potentially a fifth scholar, would go in and suggest that people practice in their household. So that's intent, and how that then influences a different part of identity all the way through the other scholars. But you're right, it's certainly transnational, and it definitely connects to what goes on in the country of origin, even if it's five generations before.
I'm Carol Isaacov from the Middle East Studies Center Advisory Committee. I'm a third generation American. When my grandparents came here from Europe, they bought into the American master story. It was easy. It was easy to buy George Washington. Psychologically, it was easy to buy the hopes and dreams of the American idea. The other country I know a little bit is France. In order to be an immigrant to France and buy into their cultural history as their own, you have to buy into Joan of Arc. You have to buy into the Crusades. And I think it's very difficult for someone coming from an entirely other religious or cultural phenomenon to buy into a history that is against you. And therefore, not only do the Muslims have their own scholars to deal with, they have the history of the country to which they're going, whether they are really welcome in that place. Carrying a passport has nothing to do with being welcome.
Well, I think that also touches on the crux of it, how, and it goes both ways, how when Muslims immigrated to different countries and were asked to work and create the foundations of the next generation of not only infrastructure but of society, and then stayed and gradually integrated in, what was the, we'll call it the contract between them? Was it that you have to then adapt and in France agree to what Joan of Arc is? You have to, if it was America, understand and believe in what was George Washington. And that's where the difference between the immigration that happened there, the connection, the cultural connection. So I think that it goes both ways, because a lot of the Muslim population, specifically in France, that came and had been there for generations afterwards, was put on the sidelines. They found it because of the difference of culture, found it very hard to then integrate or become part of traditional French culture, both because of language and cultural barriers, and because of the mere fact that they didn't have the socioeconomic standing in order to do it. So that's what I think has been problematic for the last 50 years. And I think over the last decade or so, you're having a gradual increase in the political mobilization that allows French Muslims to be able to feel French. There's one of the interesting statistics that's not mine that was pulled out is that there is in Britain 80-something percent of the Muslim populations first identify themselves as Muslim and then afterwards as British. In France, it's about 40% Muslim who, and then 40 and 40 with some people undecided, who say that it's about 40% of the people, Muslims in France, who first identify as Muslims and then afterwards who identify themselves as French. And I think that's where the problem in France sort of comes up. France doesn't care what religion you do as long as you're practicing in the private life. They really don't care as long as the first thing you say is, I'm French. You can be French Muslim, you can be a practicing Muslim and do whatever you want, but that's where you cup on the cultural connection, and you're right, that's something that's been very hard to then integrate into the French society in general, but also the Muslim population in France, which goes back to the history of unifying a very diverse cultural society in France. But I think that's where we touch on the differences and the importances, is that you find a way to then provide a two-directional integration of Muslims into society by finding ways to incorporate them more. But as Muslims, as Europe is now still bringing in more immigrants, and as they're still demanding immigrants to come in order to maintain some part of society, we didn't talk about the birthing rates in Europe, and we can talk about that if anybody's heard about the problems of that as well. But as you bring more Muslims population to Europe, both family reunification and others, it's very hard to tell them, we want you to come, but then only if you do this. And so that's where Europe is also running into an issue.
I went to school in Germany in the 70s, and so the entire cities were being built by guest workers from Turkey. And the mentality there was, come do these jobs and leave. I'm not sure when it changed or if it ever changed, but there is a non-welcoming mentality in Europe, and each country has its own version of that,
yeah.
That's supposed to be, in contrast to the United States, is melting pot. So I know that the Muslim population is growing not just by immigration but by just having children.
Yeah.
Is it becoming a majority in some places? Is it, how effectively is it immigrating? Integrating politically. And what do they do? What do people do in Europe about immigration right now?
That's right. Okay, so I'll go back. First of all, I think it's a great question. I think the main part is what you saw in the 70s in Germany. Up until about five, 6 years ago, was more or less the same concept in Germany specifically, meaning Turks or anybody who immigrated to Germany weren't given citizenship. They were given residency permits. They were working. They didn't ever leave, but they have second, third, and probably fourth generation Germans who are living there. Recently, 5 years ago or 6 years ago, the German government offered a plan to allow them to receive citizenship, and there were some conditions, including giving up more allegiances to Turkey and Turkish citizenship and so on and so forth. And actually, a surprise to the German government, a lot of Turkish Muslims living in Germany decided not to give up the Turkish citizenship in order to get German citizenship because those bonds weren't created. So I think the same concept was from the 70s all the way up to about 5 years ago, which was you can come here, you can live here, but you can't really be welcome here. You're a second-class citizen. You weren't given national citizenship, although they could influence things on a residential level. The different issue is, yeah, there are, if you look at a national level, a certain number of Muslims living in Germany or in each country, but then you have to look at more of a residential level, a local level. There are some cities where the Muslim population is 30, 40, or 50%, or even have a majority. And that's where you see differences on the local council, the municipal level, in the regional council, greater influence, which democratically is that it should be, I guess. But what you have is, on a local level, you have more influences in certain areas, and that's where the political lobbying and mobilization come together. But yet, of course, Muslims in Europe are also bearing children, like everybody else. The difference is there's also a general theme within Europe that I never really like going into this too much because I find it a little problematic and hard to measure. But the general concept is within Europe, the replacement birthing rate is at a level that is not sustainable. the general concept is you need to have a birthing rate of 2.1 children per couple in order to, because of different mortality rates, in order to maintain a society. Actually, in America, it's right around 2.1, meaning every couple has 2.1 or two, a little over two children or on average. In Europe, different countries, between Sweden all the way down to France, it's anywhere between 1.3 to 1.5, sometimes peaking at 1.9. So at different levels, you have, you're going to have an aging population. You're going to have a regular population of all, and that's on average, including the entire population, that's not sustainable, and that has long-term economic effects because then you have not enough people to work to pay off the social, I mean, I guess people here have heard about Social Security, but the problems of that, at least if you're young, I hope you've heard about it because it's a problem in the long term, but those are some of the same issues that are going on in Europe. And one of the things that you, in order to compensate that from, is by having immigration. As you have immigration come in, you then have a larger number of people who are working. As they work, they can keep society functioning. But the current trend of immigration and the numbers of immigration coming, along with the birthing rate, official European Union statistics come out and say that by 2035, even the number of immigration is not going to be enough to sustain itself. So within 20 years after, 20 years, 15 years from now, there's still going to be another breakdown or another social economic problem to fix. One of the things I was talking about is then how do you then work on both integration? I think it sort of goes both ways. Muslims are integrating a little bit of their culture into themselves, but a municipality that has a majority of Muslim citizens or residents living in it is also starting to integrate more Muslim culture into that society. So that's where some of these trends are sort of going both ways, and I think that's going to be how the over the long period of time, how the long time, that's going to help determine what Islamic political identity in Europe is. And a lot of countries right now are trying to figure out how to then focus in and promote different elements within the different, if I talked about a spectrum, find the people who are more pro-integration and be able to support them as opposed to then letting letting just anybody lobby and unify themselves.
Yes, your four scholars are political philosophers rather than simply descriptive of what they of what they see. Do you have any idea of, among the 20 million Muslims in Europe, how they see themselves in regard to these four philosophies? And in addition, does that have wild swings depending on events that that occur?
It's a great question, and certainly the answer is the short version, and it a little bit connects to the concept of then how the how it would be important to include a German scholar who influences the German population in Turkey. And in order to focus on a general European concept, the general broader concept, I found that you can't talk about influence as well. It's harder to influence. Religious scholars tend to want to influence, but as they influence, it's hard to figure out each one, each spot where there is a lot of influence. Yusuf Karadawi has a large show, a large showing fatwa, so you can say that you actually can see people who do what they do because of what he says. The same thing with Tariq Ramadan. Less so with Bassam Tibi. So what I'm trying to stay with is this influential, this causality, because once you get into causality, you have to prove it, and once you get into causality, you have to come up and ask somebody, well, are you doing it because Tariq Ramadan said you should do it? There are actually some people who say, I wear a head covering because that's what Tariq Ramadan said I should do, and move on. But then actually I find you run into a lot of different complications how to measure it on a more political analysis level. But I think it's important to find out if people are listening to him or if people are being listened to, and I think with most of those scholars you have that.
Why did you choose to study Islam?
I think growing up in Israel, there's a lot of different perspectives of the way Muslims or Islam, I can say it off, well, there's still one in the back. There's a lot of different misperceptions.
None of them are Muslim, no more.
There's a lot of different ways that Islam is perceived, and I find in relations with Muslims, every Muslim I've met, we've become close friends and found ways to bond. I think that the concept of what Islam is, especially after what's gone over here in America, there's a misunderstanding both within the Western perception and within Israel, but also within Europe, about what Islam is and what it's standing for. And I think that when you can sort of push some of those misunderstandings away, you can see there's a lot of cultural identity and a lot of ways to connect to it. Frankly, what I did was I was mentioned before, I did international law and strategic studies. I combined the two, came up with the different interpretations of the Quran in order to justify and not justify terrorism or terrorist act or violent acts. And I saw that all of a sudden, if you put those two together, you have different ways of interpreting different things. And that Islam can be this, and Islam can be that. There are several Islams. There are several different ways of interpreting. Several different scholars influence different people in different ways. And that there's a whole different dynamic, and it sort of rolled into doing it in Europe. And so that's what I find is what I found interesting and still interesting to me today.
I'm Lindsay Benstead, Division of Political Science. Thank you very much for your interesting presentation. I had another suggestion for a data source that sort of follows off on Burrell's suggestion. And that might be, I don't know if you've looked at the data from the Muslims in Europe project. Okay, you have. Because I'm wondering if you looked at that data, you might be able to get at this causality a little bit better and sort of controlling for it, because they only look at Moroccans in Spain, I think it's Pakistanis in the UK, and Turks, I believe, in Germany. There may be some questions there that might help you kind of look at the variation on identity within a certain national group, and sort of test kind of what sort of influences are shaping different kinds of identity.
And that, I agree, I haven't looked into it probably as much as I should, so I'll go and take a better look. But you're right, and those different things about causality are important to watch. And then, but structurally, and as you know, the type of research is different. So I'm trying to find ways to pull that data and the relevance of it into my research, because, and I'll probably do some more in the case studies. Those are case studies I brought up for here, but I'm going to probably take more case studies that are dealing with that and find a way to sort of bring it in and see what's really happening on the ground.
I have a little more of a secular question. which has to do with what language are you studying these people? Are you reading them in Arabic or French or German?
Everybody here writes in different languages. Most of the Muslims in Europe speak different languages. Most of them actually don't speak Arabic. Between Turks and Pakistani and Indian, most is not Arabic. So actually what I found is most of the writings is in English, at least translated in English. Tariq Ramadan initially writes in French for the most part, but most of the stuff is almost everything is translated into English. Qaradawi, most of his stuff is actually, well, I mean, he's written 60 books and thousands of articles, so I can't even say most. A small portion, but I think a significant representative portion is written and translated to English for the most part. So I'm doing it mainly in English, also a little bit in French. My Arabic is dropped a little bit, but I have enough to sort of read it, get somebody else to translate it for, or then compare to see if there's some similarities of it. But for the most part, English are the main sources because that's what they're writing in order to get the largest population, at least, and specifically the four they're trying to connect to most Muslims throughout all of Europe.
Any other question?
Okay, so first of all, thank you for your time. I want to just reiterate one or two different things. I think there's some important parts of the presentation that really was what drives me forward, But what I think is interesting is how you can take observe something in society, try to come up with a way of studying it, and then actually translate it into something interesting afterwards. So for anybody who's looking into it at a more academic level, if anybody's thinking about a PhD, only do it if you find a subject that really drives you, because if it doesn't really drive you, you're gonna run out of steam all the way through. It's a great process to go through, and I think something like this, which influences society, is important, and always be prepared to then change your opinions all the way through. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And please come to our next lecture series. Sheikh Halit Yasin, basically, he will be here. It's a very different perspective. Hopefully, May 27th, Thursday.
How's it going? And I hope I can.